Good evening and welcome to Hebron. What a lovely evening. Really nice. Nice and chilled. Thanks for coming along to hear Bodisha tonight. My name is Jill Hewitt and I'm part of the Greenbelt Talks team. And part of the things that some of us do is look out for speakers for Greenbelt and try and find new voices for you to hear. So I'm particularly delighted because I heard Bodisha on Woman's Hour and I thought, you know, I really would like to get her to come to Greenbelt. And here she is. So it's always a joy to introduce a new speaker. Bodisha is a writer, critic, and TV and radio broadcaster. She signed her first novel deal with HarperCollins, age 16. She writes for The Guardian, The FT, New Statesman, New Humanist, and various publications in the Middle East. And as I say, I heard her on Woman's Hour, and she's hosted that, I think, two or three times. Anyway, her talk this evening is International War Reportage, Giving a Voice to the Voiceless and the Journalist's Responsibility and Ethics. So would you give a really warm Greenbelt welcome to Bodisha?
Thank you. Thank you. So I go up there. Hello, everyone, and welcome, and thank you so much for being here. Whenever I'm invited anywhere, I always say yes because I enjoy it, and then I wonder what could possibly induce. I'll keep on talking at this rate and pitch, and then if you can hear me, just give me a nod and I'll carry on. Is this better? No, that's a big shaking of it. How about this? One, two, three, four. Okay, I can hear myself. The rule of broadcasting is if you can hear yourself, then the mic is on. Okay. Thank you very much, Jill. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I'm going to be speaking today about international war reportage, about voice, about ethics, and tomorrow morning I'll be talking about Palestine, and after that I'll be talking about whether it's possible to be a journalist in the digital age and what that means for the many people out there who want to get their voices heard. Is the digital revolution a good thing or a bad thing? And I'll try not to overlap in these talks. As Jill mentioned, I work in broadcasting, but in the last few years, I've worked much more in terms of international reportage and outreach work. So I currently work for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, covering international development and health. And it's one of these strange areas where you think, well, health couldn't possibly be this cool, hardcore journalistic subject. And then you realize, of course, that it intercepts with so many other areas of life. So if you look at something through the lens of health, you're looking at malaria, you're looking at AIDS, you're looking at post-traumatic stress disorder, you're looking at mental health. And of course, these things are heavily impacted by various kinds of inequality. So there's gender inequalities, there's inequalities about whether you live in a rural area or a city. And through this lens, you see the incredible impact of war and conflict. It's very easy to stay in a seemingly peacetime society and say, well, this is all good. We don't live in a warlike world anymore because we're not beheading people in the town square and we don't consider it to be a sort of Sunday afternoon's entertainment. And yet, if you look across the world, billions of people, literally billions, are embroiled in an active conflict, in what I call a fragile state, which is a state where various infrastructures have fallen down, or in the long aftermath of conflict. And that's what I want to talk about just a little bit today. I'll talk for about half an hour, but then more than anything, I think I want to hear from you and hear your questions and comments. So I think we'll then open up to the audience. As well as my journalistic work, I also do outreach work in prisons, women's and men's prisons, and young offenders institutes, and also in detention centres. And again, there's an overlap because a lot of the people I'm dealing with, working with, I have no idea what the phrase possibly is, because who knows if my presence makes any difference there at all, are people who are suffering in the long aftermath of some kind of conflict or the extreme poverty which follows a conflict. So there isn't an active war, but you have people who are suffering the after effects of violence, extreme poverty, extreme inequality, and so on and so forth. And as a journalist, as a reporter, your question to yourself is, how can I reflect what I'm seeing in a way that's not sensationalistic, it's not patronizing, it doesn't steal someone else's suffering and use it to help my own or anyone else's career? And these are ethical considerations which every journalist must bear. I'll begin by taking Hebron, the name of this venue. Who has been to Hebron? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. For those who haven't, it's one of those interesting West Bank cities where the settlements are right in the center, interwoven with Palestinians' families' homes. My last book was a tour of the West Bank and a reportage from the West Bank. It's called Beyond the Wall. I don't want to plug that, but I've been forced to say that I'm doing a book signing later today. So there you go, I've said it and that's it. I don't want to talk about that anymore. But my question for myself and for my colleagues was, when we went to tour Hebron, how did we represent it? There are some journalists who can report on the ground, as it were. So they see something and then seemingly overnight, they've produced this perfect 500 words, which is ready to go out overnight on The Guardian or The Telegraph or Reuters or one of the news wires. I can't do that. Some people can, some people can't. But what I did as a journalist was make notes. And the chapter on Hebron in the book is called 101 Closures. People who've been there know what I'm talking about. Closures are where the army, the authorities, whatever you want to call them, these are just euphemisms for control, have come in and they've shut something. So a closure can be soldering a door. It can be putting razor wire between a family home and the mosque. It can be putting various checkpoints in between places. Or it can be as basic, and I used to laugh at this, as putting an enormous meter-cubed block of concrete in the road, and this was called a road closure, or getting an enormous digger and stopping people's transit by clawing a load of earth out of the road. And I would always marvel at this because I think that all military occupations are the same. I think that all forms of control are universal, and it bothers me that 5,000 years into human society, we're still doing the same thing. We're using violence, we're using control, we're using obstruction, we're using mind games. And these things are done in a way which is interwoven. So how do you, as a writer, talk about the subtlety of things like this? If you, anywhere in the world, put a massive concrete block between someone's home and their kid's school, you're not just saying you can't get around. What you're saying is something psychological. You're saying, this might be here tomorrow, it may not be. And if you say that to people, what you're really saying is, you can't make plans. Maybe your kids will get educated, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll get to school, maybe they won't. And if you fundamentally destabilize the way someone navigates through their life, then you've absolutely won. And this is the case in all abusive scenarios, wherever in the world we're talking and whichever time we're talking at. So to bring us back to Hebron, what did I do as a journalist? I made notes. That's it. And I think that the first role of a reporter is simply to do that, to report, to write what you see. But there's a huge amount of responsibility within that. Writing what you see means don't put your interpretation into other people's mouths. Put down what is immediately in front of you. Don't give your analysis in the first or second line. You don't need to judge for the message to become clear. So as a reporter, you have to have faith in your readers. As I'm talking to you, I'm having faith in you to interpret what I'm saying. And of course, the great thing about being in a pluralistic society and in a democracy is that maybe you will multi-interpret it. You might misinterpret it, but you will have the space and the freedom to ask me to clarify. And one of the things that's great about being a journalist, rather than say, I don't know, maybe a famous novelist or a pop star or an actor, is that in the audience there are people who don't agree with you, who are at perfect liberty to put up their hand and say they don't agree and give you a chance to answer back. One of the things I found very odd about being a novelist was that in the audience were fans, and they would put up their hands and say something very complimentary, but there was no, you know, there was no grist, there was no nothing to ratchet against There was no way to argue back and forth. And if you're a journalist and a person in public life, I think you probably enjoy arguing back and forth just a little bit. And that's one of the great things about having a dialogue. I wanted also, in this talk about reportage and ethics, to talk about the differences of reportage that there are. I think that we are not always best served in terms of our understanding by the short news reports that we read. So at the time that the Middle East revolutions, which I've been writing and thinking about an awful lot, were happening, I would simultaneously, and I'm sure you did this as well, look at the news wires, look at Twitter for the immediate stuff, but then I waited for the longer essays, the contextualization, the history, the people who had been involved in revolutions in the Middle East for a long time. One of the things that lots of activists have said to me is, we don't like this phrase, Arab Spring, Arab Awakening, because what it implies is that all of these countries were somehow asleep before, or that we were just dozing, we were passive, we were dormant, we didn't feel anything, we didn't think anything. And in fact, what you have in lots of cases are the young revolutionaries, particularly the ones who are writing and reporting in English, the ones who are multilingual, who are cosmopolitan, are from very politically active families. And they will tell you, my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, my aunts, we were all involved in political activity in some way. And so whenever something kicks off, which is something that gets war reporters extremely excited because there's usually a trip in the offing and just dangerous enough to excite you, but just comfortable enough to know that when you've finished covering the fighting, you're probably at quite a nice hotel with lots of other international war reporters. I read all of that stuff, but I believe that you need to have depth as well as speed and height. You need to have analysis. You need to have something put into context. And you need to stay away from sort of alarmist reportage. It's a kind of irony that if you look at, say, the Egypt revolutions, everyone in the Western media was covering this as though it's the real emergency, whereas Egyptian commentators are saying, no, you know what? This is just the wheel turning. So someone like Morsi was going to come up. We knew he was going to fall. Then we knew that the left were going to field a candidate that everyone could get behind. This is part of the process. Meanwhile, you've got something like Syria, which I believe is absolutely a humanitarian crisis. And instead, everyone sort of sat back. And it wasn't like Egypt reporting. It was sort of watching for a very long time. What's happening? What's happening? And then finally, the entire international community is on board a moment too late when we know, for example, that the refugee camps in the bordering countries of Syria are full literally of millions of refugees. Now the international community is waking up just that moment too late. At least they didn't wait as long as in Kosovo. But that's cold comfort to me. To me, all suffering is the same. All suffering should be met immediately without question of what's right and what's wrong. Because as ever, as we all know, it's ordinary people who become collateral damage. Ordinary families, people who are not agents, who are not activists, and who certainly aren't politicians and bankers and arms dealers and arms sellers and arms buyers. So what I'm arguing for is a very optimistic view of reportage, that you have the immediacy and you also have the depth. But I also believe that we are living in a fundamentally different world. So it used to be that something would happen anywhere in the world and our chap from the BBC would stroll in and cover it authoritatively, and we would all tune in. I think we live in a fundamentally different world. We live in a multipolar world. The voice of England, the voice of Western Europe, the voice of America is no longer the one true definitive voice. We live in a world in which the energies are changing. So where is the movement? Where is the energy? Where are the voices we should be listening to? Well, Middle East, North Africa region, Southern Africa, Latin America, India, China, Japan. As someone who is second generation British, who feels themselves to be both completely British and completely international, I'm very excited by this. But again, it's not as though the ordinary people speaking everywhere are rising up. You have to look at who in those countries has the voice. And once again, it's the ones who are privileged, at least middle class, at least always speaking English. The thing that always amuses me in India now is I go there and they speak English with an American accent. So English as a language has achieved this sort of superstructural status, which is interesting. And they speak multiple other languages, and that is why they're then picked up by global news agencies. So it's not as though the democratization of reportage has really reached down to absolutely everyone. It still favors an elite. And my answer to that would be that I just feel incredibly ashamed when I'm surrounded by Arabic-speaking people and I can pick up one or two words out of it. I feel that that means that I should learn Arabic. They already speak English and French on top of Arabic. They speak all those languages perfectly. And I feel that other countries should absolutely learn other languages. It is the way into another society, and it's a way into it which is not colonial, it's a way into it which is equal. And you don't make friends unless you speak the language and you get involved. You don't make friends unless you work there, and that's how you do it. Okay, moving on. We spoke about The Voice, and given my reservations about the fact that it's already the elite and the privileged who speak, let's talk a little bit about something I'll probably touch on tomorrow, which is the digital revolution. So the voice of the BBC, the person with the big microphone on the screen, that's changing too. Here in this country, we have a relatively free press, something I'll get onto in just a moment, because of course there are always vested interests. But there has been a splintering of the voice. So I think that we're going to enter an age where those great names in war reportage will be, they will be at the top. I think there are always stars in every system. But then there'll be a multiplicity of other voices. Something interesting is happening with journalism, which is that as the amount that we're paid falls, frankly, it becomes a non-livable career. Now, we can gripe about that, and maybe I'll gripe about that for an hour tomorrow, but you can say something else, which is that now journalism is the province of absolutely everybody. So what you have is activists who are also journalists, photographers who may have been doing portraits or may have been doing art photography, who are now street photographers. You have a mixing of voices. And I think that sometimes those are the true, authentic voices. Often, unfortunately, what happens is that that direct from the ground reporting gets sort of hoovered up. I know lots of bloggers, and this has happened to me myself, who are producing extremely immediate and fresh work, only for it to be cribbed by the major papers, the major news wires, who have got the resources to research it more deeply and who have got the contacts to pull in quotes from the academics, the big names in the field. But again, I'm not completely pessimistic. I think we're at the beginning of the digital revolution, and all of the debates we're having are part of that sort of threshing motion you have at the beginning of any revolution. This is going to continue for years to come, and there will be not a control of this, but I'd say a disciplining and a structure. So we have to wait and see what happens when we shift over. One of the subheadings of the talk in the brochure today was giving a voice to the voiceless. Again, I'm very wary of patronage. Everyone has been to too many panels where the subheading is voices from the margins, speaking out, and it's all about placing someone right at the edges and implying that they're inferior and that they're less heard and somehow less relevant, and as though whatever the event is sort of doing them a kind of charity work by saying, here you are, have your 5 minutes of the stage. But I wanted to look at the theory of voicelessness. Now, who are the voiceless? Frankly, that's the majority of us. It's anyone who is ordinary, and that is 90% of the world at any given time. The ones who are not these activists, who are not cool, who are not world leaders, that's what, it's not even 90% of us, it's something like 95% of us. The ones who are not on the inside, who don't have access, who don't have, maybe they don't have a literary way of putting things. So it's not as though people are passive and stupid. It's that you're asking people to all be writers, to all behave like they're reporters, to all behave like they're Joan of Arc or the saviour of the universe and put it all into writing. Well, I think that's a huge responsibility to put onto people. People are busy, they have their lives, they all have different jobs and different things to do. You can't expect everyone to talk in quick little quotes that encapsulates what's happening in the street. But there's another kind of voicelessness which I think that journalists should be trying to reach out to and who are hard to reach out to, and that is the voice of trauma. I think it's very easy to be a reporter, to go into a dramatic place and to write something dramatic overnight based on what you saw. It involves talking about weaponry, it involves talking about bodies, it involves saying, I'm just standing over the bridge and behind me you can see the Hilton Hotel, which you don't mention because that's probably where you're staying. But then before that, you can see the rockets falling, you can see the bombs, you can just see the ambulances passing me. And that makes a very nice 5-minute video clip newsreel. That's very interesting. I'm not saying we should not have that. But if you want to get deep inside a story, particularly if you're talking about war, what you're dealing with is not just things you can see like bodies and blood and hardware and war weaponry and toys. You are dealing with trauma. That is the effect of violence, the effect of bereavement, the effect of destruction around you. It's the effect of sexual violence, which is a great unspoken thing. It's a taboo. And so when you're talking to people, you have to understand that they're not just talking out of a political situation. They're talking through all the layers which are the consequence of what it is to be in a war zone. A war zone doesn't need to be full of explosions to be a war zone. It can be the consequence. You can still be living out the consequence 30 years later when you realize that none of your family could get a job. You realize that you lost your home, you lost everything, and this is playing out. And we know that consequences go on forever. They warp, they shift. And I think a really great war reporter, which I am not, has the responsibility and the ability to put all of that into words. And to me, that's deep reportage. That's something that takes at least months. And you have to be there. You can't just fly in, do the thing in front of the camera, come back to your dinner party, and everyone goes, that was marvelous, so brave. And you go, yes, it was tough. Because it's not tough. Although we know about war reporters who've been killed, and there have been plenty, most recent in the last 18 months was Marie Colvin. And again, I'm not going on about this because although that's tragic and awful and it's a risk, relatively few war reporters are killed in the line of duty. Relatively many civilians are killed as a result of other people's actions, just living their lives, and they don't get the obituary. They don't get the beautiful collected edition of articles. They don't get names. We don't know who they are. Whenever Britain has a war, we hear the stats and it goes, 57 soldiers, 100,000 civilians. And we get nothing. You never hear what's really going on, as though the worse it is, the more dead there are, the less important they become. And I think that's absolutely scandalous. I mean, it should be the exact opposite. The more violence and suffering there is, the more we should be scandalized, and yet somehow the more numb we become, the more it just fades. It's sort of like trying to look into a crowd. If there were more of you, it would just be this blur, but I can see you now. So you recede from the action. So I'm talking here about real reportage, tackling the reality of trauma, and somehow getting to understand it. Of course, you don't do that by being very, very, very patronizing and saying, my God, what a terrible trauma you've lived through. Because again, I believe that human beings fundamentally are survivors. This is the thing that comes home to me whenever I meet anybody. If I'm in prison, I'm talking to a perpetrator or indeed a survivor. The sheer human ability to wake up the next morning and not kill yourself. If you thought about it rationally and if you listed, if you did the opposite of counting your blessings, if you counted your curses, some of these people, what they've lived through and what they've witnessed, would lose all hope. And yet there is something absolutely heroic about the notion of just surviving. I think that's something in itself. And we don't give credit for it. We don't give credit for just how big it is to simply face the world every single day in situations much worse than all of ours. And of course, I include myself in that. Let me see how we're doing for time. We're doing okay for time. So, as I mentioned, the subheading of my talk is giving a voice to the voiceless. Why are voices silenced? Now, we talked about power, we talked about privilege, we talked about class, we talked about language, we talked about being on the inside versus being on the outside. We did all of this stuff. But voices are also silenced through stigma, through shame. When someone has done violence to you of any kind, and I include endemic sexual violence in that, and the reason I mention it is because in Syria at the moment, this is absolutely an issue. Perpetrators have an amazing ability to make their victim feel ashamed. And I think that's scandalous, but it's part of what violent perpetrators and abusers can do. I'm not about to do this to you because I think it's triggering, but if I were to ask the audience if they knew a violent abuser, or if they were one, or if they had witnessed violent abuse of any kind, starting with sexual harassment and sexual violence through to murder and terrible things done to children, if we were all honest, if we had a sort of truth rain, you would be shocked by how many people put up their hands. So everybody knows what I'm talking about here. So voices also silence themselves, because part of trauma is that there are some things which are done to you, to your family, to a society, which you feel are unspeakable. Now, part of that unspeakability is sheer pain, and I don't think that everyone should be forced to open up their wound and show the world, because I think that's a violation in itself. I think sometimes pain is private, and it takes time before you're ready to talk about it. So there's that. If you speak to someone immediately after some catastrophic attack, say, a school has been bombed, and then the person who bombed it said, oh, I'm so sorry, we thought it was this, that, and the other, the insurgents were hiding there. You don't go and stick a microphone in someone's face and say, show me your pain, and then write it all down, and everyone goes, my God, what a heart-wrenching article. They may not be able to speak about it for 2 or 3 years. So I think that when it comes to pain and reportage and violence, our time frames are wrong. We like to think in the short term, and it's very unfashionable to accept the idea that trauma of various kinds, physical and mental, may take years. We live in this sort of let's move on culture. So if something terrible happens to you, you're supposed to stop crying after 6 months and then stop talking about it after a year. And that goes for a bereavement as much as it goes for anything else. People sort of get a bit bored of it. It's very unfashionable to say, no, maybe this is going to take 7 years, 7 whole years. So there is the silence of pain, and there's also the silence of stigma. Sexual violence in particular carries an enormous stigma for the survivors. They think they won't be believed, so they don't tell anyone, not the family, not the authorities. I mean, forget about the authorities. You can't even tell yourself. You can't even tell the people closest. So this is why stories like this, I mean, we saw it with Bosnia, for example, take years before the truth comes out, and then another whole bunch of years before anyone begins to believe survivors, and then another whole set of years before finally the UN, the international bodies, draft an understanding of this kind of violence into their understanding of what constitutes a war crime, what constitutes a violation of human rights. It takes a very long time. But even so, I am still optimistic, because here I am talking to you. Here you are, I hope, listening to me a little bit. And this debate has now become mainstream. So all the toxic matter is rising to the surface. And I think that that is unique. I think we are always able to move on as a world society. And there is something I'll close with that sums up everything I've been talking about, which is thanks to the digital revolution, thanks, unfortunately, to the sheer amount of world conflicts that are going on, and their seemingly localized nature, meaning that we're not in a total war situation. The world hasn't split into 2 or 3 sections. We now, as a society, understand that we are in a world society. it now looks completely ignorant and jingoistic and xenophobic to say, I only care about what happens in England or the UK and the other stuff that's happening over there. Well, it's just angry brown people. They're very angry all the time. And they can't govern themselves. This country, well, it's been chaotic for years. You can no longer say that. You can no longer claim ignorance. So we are recognizing that we are all in this together. We are seeing incredible revolutionary acts all over the world, and they are tying together all sorts of inequalities. So there's been a massive increase in women's activism. There's been a massive increase in anti-austerity measures all over the world. They are very interesting to me because they have radicalized parts of the population which may not have thought of themselves as revolutionaries before. They may not have thought of themselves as political, as keyed in, or as even caring about this, but the inequalities of the world are bringing all of this home. There is a change of thinking around climate change. There's a change of thinking around the polar bears and the bees. I mean, unfortunately, it always has to be in the figure of a sort of cute, fluffy animal for people to take notice. If, you know, if snakes were dying out, no one would bother too much. But if it's the polar bears, then my God, it's terrible. No one likes to see a very thin polar bear. Makes people alarmed. Anyway, so we are on the crest of an extraordinary wave, and everything is changing. Global politics is full of flux. Yes, it's full of flux and violence, and indeed our conversations, the things I've alluded to, are full of flux and violence. But the voices are reacting back. We are going to see in the next 15, 20 years, it's going to take a very long time, an absolute revolution in the way we cover all of these things. And I think the fact that I could hold your attention, the fact that you seem avid, the fact that we can cover so much in just 35 minutes absolutely gives me hope that we are going to see a revolution, not just on the ground, but in terms of journalism and reportage as well, because language and ideas always follow events. So we will see a rise in really good quality writing and analysis and archiving and testimony and witness statement. And I will close just by saying that I absolutely believe that while the pen is not mightier than the sword, the word can change the world, because it has done. And if societies can change for the worse, they can transform for the better. So I will close there, and I'd really like to hear your questions and comments and so on and so forth. Thank you very much.
Good. Well, I'm very pleased I invited her. Would you mind coming up here if you have questions, and we'll take a couple at a time, so feel free just to step up and take the mic, and we'll keep an eye on the time.
Thank you very much. It was very insightful.
Thank you.
I hear you. I understand you. I've also read the book of the Dutch journalist Joris Luyendijk,
great,
which you have obviously also read. And how do you put what you say against what I see on the television when you look at the journalism in the United States, and what I see on television is more like opiniocracy than a democracy?
That's a fantastic question. Yes, you mentioned US journalism. It really bothers me because, number one, there is just so little coverage of international affairs. And that's true on TV, and it's true in newspapers. So there's that one page. And I absolutely agree. I think that the US is the last place that has to sort of be broken down the way I'm talking about things being broken down. You are absolutely right. And you're also right to bring up the idea of opinions, because I believe that you have to be there and you have to report what you see. And I have noticed that as there are more and more and more channels and more outlets, particularly in the US, and we're talking about mainstream channels here, they have to fill the space. And they know they can do it by people who don't have a lot of knowledge but who've got a big mouth and a loud voice. And the more extreme they are, the better. And it seems to be that news has become entertainment. So producers will get people who they know are going to clash. And you're supposed to sit back and watch it as though it's a boxing match. I still think that there are great US journalists. They're probably writing for the magazines. And I think that there is a great groundswell of very young US students who are studying international relations. I suspect that either they work for the UN in New York, or they come to Europe and they work in NGOs and human rights organizations there. But you are absolutely right to bring this up, and I think it's the last place. When I turn on Fox News, I know, I see you wince, this is so funny like this. I don't think that news and human rights ever should be entertainment, and I just don't understand it. And I think it also is very, very unfair to the audience because it plays on their ignorance. You know, I got a message from a Middle Eastern guy saying, you know, why is it that every time we're on either Fox News or CNN, really, they see lots of angry men in the streets and a camel and a woman in a veil crying, going through some rubble. You know, the cliches, absolute cliches. So I think that's the last place that really needs to just open up. Not that there aren't brilliant people there, but I don't think they're in the media. I think the US media is an industry in itself, absolutely led by advertising and therefore subject to advertising and by money. It's a very tricky place. Thank you for bringing that up, though, because you're absolutely right.
Do you have any ideas of techniques, either from a journalistic point of view, of getting what you're saying, you know, actually is happening across, but also possibly more importantly from those of us who are in the 95% of how we should listen or how we should leaf through all the huge amounts of content to actually get the real story?
Again, that's a fantastic, fantastic question. I agree with you that there's a huge amount of stuff out there. There's something like 60 million blogs, and I'm certainly not suggesting that everyone has to leaf through everything. I think that what's happening is a kind of aggregation. So I read The Guardian, but not the main section. They do these great things called blog networks. So if you're interested in the Middle East or you're interested in Southern Africa, I look at the network that they host, and all the newspapers are beginning to do that. I look at the very basic news wires like Reuters and Bloomberg and the BBC, and I see who they're linking to. And I do very basic Google searches. I don't believe in going really doing what I call a bungee jump way down to page 17 of Google, but I do believe that if you type in the very basics, you get the strongest voices do come up. But you're absolutely right that there is a crazy multiplicity of voices. And then what we're going to see is that these are going to be sort of aggregated and corralled and funneled into various institutions. What's happening, which is interesting, is these writers are still not being paid. So there's going to be a kind of drop-off in voices. What was the other thing that I was going to say? The other thing that I'd recommend is creating groups. So my next question to you would be, and I won't put you on the spot, is whatever you're interested in, you start hosting and linking and tweeting and participating. Because I think it feels that if you're on the outside that you are kind of, there's this endless morass of things that you're supposed to read. But actually, if you begin searching them out, you discover that the really interesting analytical voices are relatively in the minority. And you then have to find a way to retweet and to ask and to go into it. There are other websites I look at. Open Democracy is a fantastic one, which gathers together the most important voices in international relations whatsoever. But I also believe in something that lots of journalists don't agree with, which is the NGOization of journalism. So it's the crossover between journalism, human rights, and charity work. So if I'm interested in Syria, which I am, one of the best ways is to type in something to do with what is the major charity working in Syria? Who is the aid agency trying to get in? Something extraordinary has happened with journalism, which is that now aid workers, people who are literally on the ground, literally in the refugee camps, are reporting, and they are producing the most incredible footage, speaking to people, photography, trying to get what they're seeing out there, because they're noticing that the BBC or Guardian, whoever, they're not listening. So I believe in going straight to the charities and the activists and the aid workers. They're not all journalists, so there's a lot to leaf through, but the raw, unvarnished footage is there. And of course, there's a lot of it, but you know, you stop when you realize what the general picture is. And it brings me to another fantastic point, which is this opening up of human rights and charity. It used to be very unfashionable to be a journalist and also be interested in human rights. The idea is that you go in there, it's a kind of slash and burn thing, and you do your piece, and then you go. And I think that journalists should have a human rights angle. I absolutely think that's correct, because what are we all here for? You can make the world better, or you can make it worse, or you can help your career, or you can do something a bit useful for humanity, even if it's just one little thing. So what's happening, which I'm doing, which a lot of the people you're probably reading are doing, is that journalists like me are becoming human rights activists, and we are working more for charities or for human rights organisations than for the BBC. As it happens, for my sins, I do work for the BBC, but the other 50% of my job is for the Gates Foundation. Why? Because they're taking their squadrillions of dollars and they're trying to make the world better. And what I do is I comb every major international development website and report. I read UN reports, World Health Organization reports. They're very, very dry, but my job is to then make it less dry. So check out the International Reporting Project as well, which is one of the people I contribute to. Sorry, very long-winded, because it's a passion, so sorry, it got me.
The answer which you've just given, I think, actually goes quite a long way towards answering my question too, but I'll put it anyway because there might be a slightly different perspective. When you spoke about the multiplicity of voices, you spoke about many of them often coming from activists, people who are already politically engaged. And I just wondered how you judge the danger that you're getting an agenda being pushed rather than the sort of dispassionate analysis that you would hope for from the big names who you suggest sort of stand above that.
I think you're absolutely right to bring that up. One of the reasons, and I think rightly, why a lot of the established media outlets didn't use activist footage was because of exactly this issue, and I completely agree with that. So they said, listen, this footage is unverifiable. They're saying that all of these soldiers came into Tahrir Square and they beat up and tortured all of these people, but you can't date it. You can't identify the perpetrators, all the victims, all the bystanders. We can't even identify the street. People are claiming that they were at this place and they witnessed this thing. I completely agree with you. I think that everyone has got to be rigorous about this. What's happened is that this opinionocracy that you brought up in the last, just in the last 2 or 3 years, I think actually it was around the Middle East revolutions, because I think there was a real recognition on the part of reporters that we have to make this as balanced as possible. We have to be verifiable. We have to be rigorous. So the opinionocracy has broken away from the reporters, and there is now an increasing level of, this is what I saw, this is the footage, these are the people, these are the quotes, these are the contacts that you can use to verify us. I'll use one example. There's a collective in Egypt called Mosserine, if anyone's heard of them. They are young photographers and journalists, and they began filming all around the revolutions in Egypt, and exactly this issue came up, and they thought, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to put all of our footage online, but we're going to verify every single bit of it, and then we're going to give Al Jazeera, BBC, Reuters, whoever, permission to use it, all verified. We're going to put names to this. So I absolutely agree that while you might enjoy kind of sinking into that great sea of voices, there has to be some sort of, not a brand, not an institution, but something that tells you that this isn't just some lone nutter who's made up some stuff about some stuff that's happening. And that's why I believe that in the next 2 years, I think following on from all of this, because these are absolutely correct issues, there will be a kind of aggregation of voices around institutions. That's exactly why I consented to working with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, because you trust them. I trust them. I think it's hilarious that they spent 40 years becoming gazillionaires and then they decided to be like St. Francis of Assisi. It's a really American, I mean, I don't mean specifically American, it's a really American dream way of thinking, which is like, I'll act like an arch-capitalist for this amount of time and then be an arch-philanthropist for the rest of my life. But I think they're doing the right thing. But this is exactly why I stopped blogging. I loved blogging. It gave me a really good name. I realized that the newspapers were cribbing all of my work anyway. And also that you could just say to me, well, you might just be not telling the truth. And so I worked for a bigger company. I began to use citations. So every claim has some kind of proof. Every, even the smallest statistic is linked back to whatever it is, the Home Office, the World Health Organization. I believe that journalism should be rigorous and it shouldn't just be opinion. I think you get that when you're passionate and you're an activist and you want to change the world and there's a place for it. But I also have faith in readers. And I think that the best way to sway readers is actually not through that passion, which can be quite repetitive. I think it's a great sort of spur at the beginning of being in a movement, but then you need the analysis, and you need campaigns, and you need objectives, and you need to say, well, I want to change the world, I want to change it. And then the answer is, well, what do you want to change it into? What are you fighting for? So you're absolutely right. I take your point. And there needs to be real rigor, because that's what you remember as well. That's what really persuades you, is a reasoned argument. That's why when you watch two politicians shouting at each other, no one is persuaded of anything. Last one. This is a bit like death row. I feel a bit... next one up.
My question is slightly different in that you talked a bit about trauma and how difficult it is to get over what that's been like for people, because people want the snapshot drama of the current issue. And I wondered how you, I wondered if your fiction is something that you can then use in order to bring in these more difficult, longer term issues.
That is an absolutely fantastic question, and I'm always on the back foot when people ask about fiction. Yes, it's true that I published two novels when I was a teenager, and I acknowledge the success, it was all very nice, but I feel in my heart that I'm not a fiction writer. So my answer to you is that a true novelist, a true artist, can do that. I think they have an ability to get under the skin of characters. I think you're absolutely right that these very deep emotional experiences, which are often, I mean, talking about something as though it's emotional makes it sound soft, but actually we're talking about really hardcore emotions. I think that fiction is a great place to explore that, as is all art. I think dance is, I think opera is, I think that film can be. And I think it takes a very skilled non-fiction writer to do that. So yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think I'm probably not the person to do it, but I think others are. When I went to the West Bank, I was led by the Egyptian novelist Adaf Suef, and everyone was saying to her, why don't you write a novel about it? And she said, no, but the thing is, we're in the thick of the action now. And when you write fiction, you have to literally close the door and, in my case, unfortunately, almost chain yourself to the desk. And she said, I can't lock myself away. So there was a split between feeling a commitment to talking about all the activity that was happening and saying, okay, you know what, in 10 years' time, when it's really settled, I think that's when you write the novel. When you've seen at least some of the consequences play out. But I am very happy to hear your faith in fiction, because we're at a time when book sales are sort of plummeting. So it makes me wonder where the space is for talking about these things. And I think you're right. I think real great literature can do that, which is why we still read Middlemarch hundreds of years later. I'm sorry, I keep fluffing this microphone, but I can't figure out what's doing it, so...
Sorry, this is also about trauma, actually. You mentioned that trauma can take years to develop and often worsens. Have you ever had the opportunity to go back to the same place or speak to the same people? And if you have, what did you learn from that?
That's a fantastic question, and you are absolutely right that I should do that. I haven't done that, actually. I haven't done that as a journalist. I've done it as an outreach worker. But there hasn't been a gap. So I've been doing outreach in prisons for a very, very long time. Particularly in women's prisons, what you've got is this very interesting, what I call a traumatic situation, which is that the profile of women in women's prisons is sort of different. It's often very starkly related to crimes of poverty. So there are things like repeat thefts, repeat non-payment of TV license, things which are so small and yet they accumulate. And there's a very high proportion of people who have suffered massive inequality. You know, if you talk to some of the women about their sort of experiences and their upbringing, there was often a background of abuse of some kind. And prison traumatizes them because, of course, you go into prison and you lose your kids. If there isn't someone to look after them, everything falls apart. So the bottom drops out of everything, even if you're just in for a tiny, you know, for some very minor crime. And then they go mad. And I use that phrase absolutely colloquially. And it makes everything worse. What I haven't seen, which I'd like to see, is that gap between someone who's at the beginning of the recovery process and at the end of it. I've seen people who are in the middle. And again, it astonishes me that sometimes the way to survive is literally just to write a list. Not of things like, I'm going to overcome my trauma and stop cutting myself. I mean, I saw a woman in prison who... Sorry, this might be triggering, so let me headline that.
who had self-harm cuts from here to here, every 2 millimeters up, and it was shocking. They were raw, and you could tell which ones were the oldest ones and which ones were the newest ones because of the shade of red. And what saved her was not kind of deep therapy, but just having a job in the library. You know, this tiny little thing, it just means you have to show up at a certain time, check in the books, check out the books. And you do see people begin to heal. And it's this amazing thing, because you think that it would take this kind of messianic figure to do this amazing miraculous thing. And what it takes is just the building blocks of creating a life and bringing people out of themselves. The worst thing, as I'm sure you, as everyone knows, is the trauma repeats on itself when people are alone and can't talk to anyone. And it lessens when you're with people, even if you're not talking about it. Just that sheer presence of other human beings makes a difference. But you're absolutely right to bring it up. And in fact, I know of very few war reporters who went back. And there's a whole thing to be said about the classic idea of the war reporter who goes in, does their bit, and then never, never, never looks back. And in fact, a very serious charity who was dealing with women who'd been trafficked internationally got in touch with me and said, listen, you know, this reporter came and he said that he would hide the names and faces of everybody, and he didn't. And it absolutely traumatized the survivors. Absolutely. And they never heard from him again. And I think that's shocking. I think it's so irresponsible. I think that's a traumatic act in itself. I think that's an attack in itself. Because he had promised these women, I will protect you, and he didn't. So, but you're right to bring it up, and there should be a long-term view of trauma. You're absolutely right. One more.
I was just curious about your experiences working at the BBC, because obviously it's probably better than Fox News, but it's still the state broadcaster, and there's some situations where things seem to kind of threaten the institutions. I'm thinking, for example, the riots in London, and when Operation Cast Lead happened, that it did seem like the BBC was pushing something of an agenda. So just the extent to which you feel that ever your work is perhaps censored a little bit, or you feel kind of in a bit of a box, and particularly what you feel about, you were talking about, as a reporter, it's important to give the first-hand account, and then people can make up their own mind. But it seems that often the way the BBC reports, it's kind of the voice of God.
Yes.
They have this sort of objective thing, and that's obviously puts them in a position where people kind of take it very authoritatively. So that's perhaps a position of responsibility as well, and what you feel about that.
You're so right to bring up the BBC. It's a very institutionalizing institution, to the point where I was at the Edinburgh Festival and I went to see a drama about the BBC, and I thought, how institutionalized do you have to be that you go and see something about your workplace when you're on holiday? You're absolutely right, and in fact, I think it does see itself as the voice of God. It sees itself as the absolute definitive. And because it believes in itself as impartial, it doesn't believe that it's not impartial, and it doesn't realize that it's not being, when it's being one-sided. I think you're absolutely right. They have finally bowed to pressure, and I think that this is to do with the events that you mentioned. It's to do with public criticism, which is very, very sharp at the moment. It's to do with the Leveson inquiry, which looked into vested interests, and it's to do with all kinds of inequalities. So people were saying, you know, where are the women over 50? Why are you covering this particular conflict in such a way? Why did you not cover Syria for a long time? Why did you just show the angry Arab people in the street and the camel and the woman in the veil? It's changing very slowly, but as with all institutions, particularly ones which are very proud of themselves, it takes, you know, it takes an elephant's push to make an ant's step of progress. I can say that it is changing, and it depends very much on the staff. You know, this endless kind of revelations that we're hearing about Jimmy Savile and stuff like that. I mean, it really shows you what an institutionalized institution is. I used to joke that it was like working for the CIA, because they would always know what you had been doing. So I would be in my room, and someone would come in and say, well, I understand you were at Greenbelt on Sunday. And you'd go, how would you know? And they say, well, you know, I understand it was at 5 o'clock, your talk. So they are incredibly authoritative. What keeps us there is that I think that when they do well, they do incredibly well. They have the resources at least to send someone to the conflict instead of just grabbing stuff off the news wires. They do arts coverage incredibly well. And they give more time. So we're talking, I mean, Fox News is the worst example to use, because if something enormous happens, they'll give it 30 seconds. And they'll go, brown people are angry somewhere, and here's some coverage of an explosion. The BBC at least will do probably quite one-sided, immediate reportage. Then they'll do an hour on Newsnight. You know, something I notice, again, I keep mentioning Syria because it's at the top of my mind. I'm not a Syria expert. Newsnight have started doing these amazing panel discussions with actual Syrian people talking about Syria for a long time. And I think that's something they do very well. But again, I'm so institutionalized, my false consciousness is probably making me defend it to you. It has lots of problems, but what's the alternative? The alternative is being some sort of amateur blogger working for free. It's working for ITV, who are completely commercial channels, subject to all sorts of things. Or it's working for the UN, where you're doing the right stuff, but you want to be a journalist. So anyone who works there makes a little deal, not with the devil. Me and my colleagues used to call it the golden turtleneck. You know how you can have golden handcuffs, and the image of the golden handcuffs is they're painful. With the golden turtleneck, it's flattering, but it's claustrophobic. And that's what it's like working for the BBC. So everyone else goes, my God, that golden turtleneck looks so good on you. And you say, no, but it's very clingy. And they say, no, keep it on, keep it on. It looks fantastic. So that's what it's like. And like everyone, I love it because it reaches so many people. And of course it's a constraint. Of course it's a constraint. And it makes me very sad to see the way the World Service has been cut down. That's my RIP for the BBC.
Absolutely. That was great. Thank you, Padisha.